I was just thinking of a guy who's like, hey man, that guy's a real audiophile. Like, you got to stay away from him.
That's so stupid.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, he's always, you know, I don't know. I just like looked on his computer the other day. He was looking at these really expensive headphones, man. Like, he's got studio speakers at his house. Like, what are you listening to, man?
This like, reminds me of, I had a character when I was younger, much younger, but my character was the person who, like, it is like a malaprop, person with a malaprop problem.
What's malaprop?
When you accidentally use the wrong word, but it sounds very, very close to what it's
Gotcha, yeah.
So they would be like, yeah, man, that's such a nautical idea.
Yeah, I knew a guy. No, that's actually fucked up because
like,
I knew
a
guy.
Yeah, hard on.
I'm gonna take that clip of you saying yeah hard on. I'm gonna put that as my text tone for whenever I get a text.
Don't.
I'm gonna get that. It's a free country, baby. I can do it. Ugh. It's fine for me to do. I'm a little.
Is this how the commons works or whatever? Now that I've said it, it's just everyone owns it. Is that it? What is that called again?
I don't know. Whenever commons? People talk about the commons, I'm like, what are you? Is that a college thing? Like, what are you talking? Is that like the quad?
Yeah, I don't know what that is. Commons. It sounds like a cafeteria.
I have no interest in whatever your commons are. I like rare things, like diamonds.
Mm.
Yeah. I mean, actually,
I like
pretty
diamonds.
Much do you have you ever had
when
one?
Are you buying no. me diamonds?
I actually. So this is crazy. You mentioned this. I bought you a super rare diamond. From this kid I know, and it turns out, so, all right, so this is kind of like a cheap thing for me to say. So I bought the diamond and then unfortunately, like this, like weird, like, UN task force or whatever made me give it back. And apparently I have to go to prison or whatever, but like, I'm sure it'll work out.
That's so romantic.
Yeah. It's cool. It's called like a mud diamond or something. I wasn't really paying attention to what you said. But yeah, it was only like $75.
How would one even go about buying a blood diamond?
I don't know. It sounds more magical than I thought it would be. I think you have to go to, doesn't like,
it sounds like it's a thing where it's like, you know, a guy who knows a guy who knows a guy who knows a guy. And then suddenly you're like, you know, on a plane to Africa.
I'll be honest with you. Probably, our producer and I have family members involved in this business.
Boy, oh boy, oh boy. Guess what? I'm starting this one. Hello.
Provichnik.
I was not expecting that. Hello,
Slava
everyone.
Slava Franzak! Slava Franzak!
What is Slava? What are you saying?
Oh, well, okay. That's a little spoiler alert. Well, Slava... Well, let's say Slava Ukraina is like a...
Oh, yeah. Don't say
not,
that.
Not... Yeah. Well, I didn't say Slava Ukraina. I said Slava Franzak. No one's ever... It's actually kind
of
an art thing.
That's not even how you say my name.
Frank Zach.
No.
It's Franzak, I know, but it's... I was doing it in an accent. Franchek.
No, Franchek.
Friend.
If you want to do the accent.
Frenchman.
Oh, my God. Hello,
Liz
welcome.
Frenchman.
My name is Liz.
My name is Slava Brace. We're reappropriating it. They killed us, dude. We can say it.
We are, of course, joined by our producer, Young Chomsky. And
Slava Chomsky.
This is Truanon. Hello.
Slava Truanon! Hello. Sorry, I'll stop. I swear to God, I'll stop. I'm really sweaty right now, baby. I fucked up.
Why are you so sweaty?
I turned the... It was really cold in here earlier, and I turned the heat on, and now I'm hot as hell, because I forgot I have to close the doors to my bedroom when I record here. So now I'm really warm.
It's like a whole hot box. You got a sauna going.
I'm here. Okay. Hold on. I'm doing
no,
it.
No, keep your shirt on, please.
Baby, just okay.
All right. So today we've got, I think, a fun episode. We're talking about a big country that little people know about, meaning few people know about.
I want to kind of give us a pat on the back here, because we've already recorded the interview. Mm. Spoiler alert. We did it. Nothing happened during it that was prevented from finishing. And neither Liz nor I said, and of course not our guests, said the Ukraine once. we just straight up said Ukraine the whole time.
Why do people say that? What is that whole thing?
I don't. It sounds right. I think like
it's
I
not honestly right, don't. Though.
I think when it was like maybe part of like the Russian Empire, it was called the Ukraine or something. Mm. But
it's a very millennium thing. Like it reminds me of like people saying the Ukraine. Like it's very like 1999 to 2001.
Oh, it's like how people used to call it the internet, but now people are just like, hey, I'm on internet today or whatever. Like people don't say the internet anymore.
No, so what are we talking about? Yeah, we're talking about Ukraine. Nazis, of course, Brace's favorite topic.
Mm-hmm. I will say, little thing here, this is a Spider Network episode.
We get to talk a little bit about my favorite topic, the Atlanta Council. Mm-hmm. And we did not get to talk about Hunter Biden, but...
his name was mentioned, it came up.
We need a little, like, here, because...
Whoa! That is a editorial... hold on. Chomsky, hold off with that chick here. You've got to... Are we chick-chicking Hunter Biden?
No, he's our... Isn't he our... Yeah, why not? Of course.
Did you... you just did a gesture like you thought he was dead. Do you think someone killed Hunter Biden?
No. I don't understand. What is with the memification of Hunter Biden? He fucking sucks, man.
You are out of your fucking mind. Are you serious? All right. Guy is a poon hound. He lies a lot. He had sex with his brother's wife. He's a scam artist, and he's a loser.
No, I mean, I get why you boys did that, but I, as someone who has been following what was going on in the Ukraine with the Obamas and the Bidens for a long time, I just did that on purpose for you, baby.
Right. I'm sorry.
I don't find it very funny. I don't find the memification of Joe Biden or Hunter Biden very funny.
I think Hunter Biden's cool because I think losers are cool. And also because love drugs.
You think he's cool because you would also like to be propped up by NATO.
I am propped up by NATO, dude. Have you looked at the subscriptions of our podcast? 98% of them come from Israel and the other 2% come from an army base in Germany.
All right, let's get to it.
Well, we're back. Nope, that's awful. Not going to do that. We're not back from anywhere. We haven't.
Keep it going. Anywhere. Keep it going. This is good.
Okay. You know, Liz, I got to say, a little frustrated you didn't jump in there.
I just did.
I know, but didn't jump in before. I mean, listen, if the stuff we're talking about today.
Oh, so too little, too late. Always. All
right. Well, it's just.
If I jump in too quickly, then I'm interrupting. If I jump in too late, I'm not ticking your cue.
Ever heard of something called a sweet spot?
He likes it just right.
Exactly. Well, we have with us today I didn't know what to call him before this, but let's say an independent private investigator, Moss Robison, who has a blog. You know, I'm not a big Blogspot guy. You know, I'm not that you have a Blogspot. I don't mean to do you like that. But he's got this Bandera Lobby blog, which are two words that if you connect them together, make a super word that attracts my attention. It is a fantastic, blog about his research into the activities of the Organization of Ukrainian Nationalists in America and worldwide. Fantastic blog. And we have him here today to discuss just what the fuck the Bandera Lobby is. And what are they lobbying for, and what the history is behind it? Moss, how you doing?
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
First of all, it's weird that you're into this, and so I wanted to ask you, because when I started reading your blog, I was like, "What? This is a topic that very much attracts my attention." I started reading about Stepan Bandera a while ago, and it's just such a strange fucking figure with such a weird cult-like legacy. And I was delighted to find your blog, but I'm wondering, like, how did you sort of get interested in this topic?
Well, I've been falling down this kind of rabbit hole for a while. I had something of a turning point about a year and a half ago, when I visited this Ukrainian cemetery in New Jersey. And, at the time, if you'd asked me what this was all about, it was kind of just my own interest in this sort of little known chapter of the Cold War history. And I was looking for the grave of this guy, Mykola Lebed, who was used to be a big shot in this thing, the Organization of Ukrainian Nationalists. And the most radical faction of the OUN, led by this guy, Stepan Bandera. And so that's the OUNB faction, B for Bandera. And the thing is, Lebed was, for a while, the de facto leader of the OUNB in, like, 1941-42. And he was arguably a bigger war criminal than Bandera. But he...
That's a tall order.
Well, Bandera spent a lot of the war in a concentration camp, albeit as a privileged political prisoner. We can talk about that later. But basically, Lebed ends up leading this thing called the Foreign Representation of the Ukrainian Supreme Liberation Council, and which was created by the OUNB. But long story short is that Lebed and this group have a falling out with Bandera and split with him in 1948, which is when the CIA is getting into the swing of things. And so the CIA picks a side and they pick Lebed.
Oh, and, what a shocker.
Yeah, and so what I did not realize, I knew when I was going there that Lebed is buried in this special section of this cemetery, which is a pretty prominent Ukrainian cemetery, among others. I mean, there's a lot of people buried there, but right in the front, I found out the day I get there, is Dmytro Donsov is buried there, he's the guy who translated Mein Kampf into Ukrainian, and he wasn't himself a member of the OUN, but he was kind of like the unofficial, like, leading ideologue of the OUN, and especially the OUNB. So I knew Lebed was buried in the special section of the cemetery, but I did not realize is that a lot of the people buried with him were like him, these Nazi-turned-CIA collaborators. And so... At the time, I also kind of naively, emphasis on the word naively, assumed that the OUNB ceased to exist after the Soviet Union collapsed, or at least just became irrelevant. But, and I was living up in New Paltz, New York, just kind of near, the Catskills and stuff. And what I did not realize, and I came to realize in looking more into some of these people who are buried in this section of this cemetery, is that on the other side of the mountains outside my window in New Paltz was the summer camp, which is where you can find the world's oldest monument dedicated to Bandera. And in finding about the summer camp is kind of what led me to realize that the OUNB still exists, which was kind of a freaky, surreal.
Yeah, it's like you suddenly realize, like, this one little thing that I was kind of interested in is this, like, radiating, much bigger, crazier story than you even anticipated.
Yeah, and I knew it was relevant to stuff that's going on today, but I didn't realize how much, I guess, that's like a understatement.
Well, I have, like, two immediate questions just from you saying that is... that maybe will serve as, like, a good jumping off point, which is, one, why the hell are all these Ukrainian Nazis buried in the United States? that's something that just sticks out, right? Like, first of all. And two, who is Stepan Bandera? Because I don't, his name is not, I'm sure that some of our listeners maybe have heard his name, or my assumption is that the majority haven't, only because, like you say, like, Ukrainian history, in terms of the Cold War and even in World War II, is like a bit niche, I think, is as you described it. It's like Ukraine in general is sort of this, like, kind of oddly placed country in terms of geopolitical history. And so it kind of occupies, like, a weird place in our, like, narratives about the Cold War and even World War II.
So to briefly answer the first part, the Ukrainian American community is an elsewhere, especially pre-World War II, is far from any kind of monolith. But then after World War II, the overwhelming majority of Ukrainian emigres coming to the United States and Canada and Australia and elsewhere, were from Western Ukraine, which, was part of Poland, and before that Austria, and then before that Poland again.
And you'll get it back one day, Liz. I swear to you, I will do this for you.
We might be okay with, maybe we're good on that one.
Well, but that part of Western Ukraine was where the nationalists and the OUN comes from.
Oh, yeah, so, true. Also, by the way,
Banderistan, as some of the internet calls it, yeah?
And so Bandera's from there, too, and he basically, I guess long story short, the OUN is founded in 1929, and he's like a founding member and quickly rises through the ranks of the OUN. And his notoriety, and same as Michael Lebed, stems from this 1934 assassination of the interior minister of Poland. Mm-hmm. And something about that is that, so Bandera is the one who gives out the order, perhaps at on behalf of the international leadership of the OUN, by which at that point was based in Western Europe, in like Vienna and Berlin and Rome. And then Michael Lebed is the one who more supervises the thing and manages the assassin, who himself gets away, and he ends up making his way to South America. And in 1941, the US government is convinced that he's on a mission by the Germans and even the Gestapo, I think, to assassinate FDR.
Mm.
And so obviously that doesn't happen, but the Secret Service is suspecting of this Ukrainian bishop in the United States, Ivan Buchko, who, if not already, soon becomes like the Vatican's chief advisor on Ukrainian affairs.
Wonderful.
And then after the war, he helps introduce the CIA to Michael Lebed,
who's
the guy who oversees this.
And who 6 years before they thought was going to shoot the American president. They're like,
he was the guy who was managing the guy who they thought was going to do that.
Yeah.
But so by the time that 1941, the U.S. government learns about this, Bandera and Lebed had been sentenced to death, and then that was commuted to life imprisonment. When they got their sentence, they made a fascist salute and said, you know, Slava Ukraini, glory to Ukraine. And they then get out of prison, depending on who you ask, escape or are released just after the invasion of Poland. And so in the first weeks of World War II, they're free, and then Bandera makes his way to Rome, where the new leader of the OUN is, and then challenges him, and there's really
that's,
this general...
That's Andrei Melnyk, right?
Yeah, and so then you have, as a result of this, mainly generational struggle. You have the OUNM for Melnyk and the OUNB for Bandera, and the OUNB is the one that's basically ends up dominating in Western Ukraine, and so Bandera basically becomes the spokesperson for this more radical, more extreme faction of the OUN, led by these young people.
So, just real quick, when we talk about, like, what, you know, we say, like, Ukrainian nationalism, you know, what Bandera is fighting for, can you kind of explain, like, what his beliefs were? Like, what is, like, Ukrainian nationalism, like, in this context?
Well, something that they would say, Ukrainian nationalists would say then and perhaps now, is that they weren't fascist because these were uniquely Ukrainian ideas, but that's something all these fascist movements, you know.
Right.
That's one thing about the OUNB that's funny, is because, you know, they call Bandera the, I don't know how to pronounce it, but it's V-O-Z-H-D.
Mm-hmm.
Which is basically the same thing as like the Führer, and they follow what's essentially the Führer principle, like the Führer principle, like this leader principle, and like it's essentially like identical to you know, the more well known fascist movements.
Yeah, and Melnyk and others. Well, Melnyk in I think 1938 writes to von Ribbentrop and says, you know, for us, Ukrainian nationalism is akin to fascism in Italy and national socialism in Germany. And so people often...
Ribbentrop, by the way, for listeners who aren't familiar with this, Joachim von Ribbentrop, right, is the foreign minister of Nazi Germany.
And so, people refer to Bandera and so as Ukrainian Nazis. And I guess it's more or less correct, but you know, for them, like capital N Ukrainian nationalism, I think is more or less equivalent to, you know, how when you don't call Italian fascists or capital F fascists Italian Nazis, but I mean, it's like they're
right.
equivalent.
Or and it's so, like the same case in like Romania too, which is like a kind of a different fascist flavor, but still explicitly fascist.
Well, they're actually very similar to the Ukrainians in that they found farm tools to be useful implements in taking care of my people.
Mm-mm. Yeah, yeah. And there's a whole, we could probably spend a lot of time getting into some of the more nuanced and complicated stuff about the specifics of the OUN and the OUNB's collaboration with the Nazis. It was a bit complicated, but I mean, at the end of the day, they started the war as collaborators and they ended the war as collaborators.
Yeah, they were kind of like classic frenemies, right? Mm-hmm.
Like, they had, yeah.
They kind of had like a useful, they were like, the Ukrainians were useful to the Nazis until they weren't, and then they were like useful again, kind of, maybe.
Yeah, I think they'll say that this was all a strategic thing, but
there was yeah, that's very what they
strategic.
Say.
It wasn't. Yeah, yeah. It wasn't very strategic to like put your faith in Hitler to free Ukraine because he had no interest in doing so.
Well, that's the thing a lot of these like European fascist movements thought would happen. I mean, you saw the same thing with the Iron Guard in Romania and the Aerocross Party in Hungary. In that they thought that like when Hitler came and took over the country, he would naturally put his brother fascist in power. What actually ended up happening in most of these countries, Hungary, Romania, is that actually put like more authoritarian nationalists in power, like usually old school military men. I mean, certainly Miklos Horthy in Hungary fits the bill there. And then only in like desperation, specifically again with Hungary, would he like turn to the actual fascists there because they would be loyal no matter what because, you know, it's a very cucked thing to be, especially with the Aerocross. I mean, my God, what babies. But the thing is, like, when Hitler invaded Ukraine, Hitler wasn't like invading Ukraine to free Ukraine. I mean, there was some propaganda to that effect. He was invading Ukraine for Lebensraum, for living space. Like that was supposed to be like the Western frontier, literally the Eastern frontier for the Nazis, where the SS men would live as like the knights of yore and have these farms, and Ukrainians would serve as like cattle and serfs. And so like there was
great
never
farmland.
Any-
By oh, the way, yeah, in Ukraine. Yeah. I mean, beautiful.
You should see these sunflowers.
There's the reason why so many people want it.
Mm-hmm. And so the Ukrainian nationalists, you know, in 1941, they declare a state in Ukraine, and that does not go over very well with the Nazis. And yeah, I mean, that's again, like you were right. It's probably a little too much history to get into here. But the important thing is that they started end of the war. With the Nazis, and that they committed a lot of, let's say, similar actions in Ukraine as the Nazis themselves did there. And the Nazis were not known for being kind to our brothers and sisters in Ukraine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I guess the short version of it is that a lot of the things that Ukrainian nationalists will say about what happened in World War II is just not true. And you know, one of the things that's important is that they infiltrated, the OUNB in particular, infiltrated some of these auxiliary police units that served at, like, the front lines of what people will call the Holocaust by bullets. And then from there, defected after it was clear the Germans were going to lose. They create the Ukrainian insurgent army, which is, more than anything, seemed to prioritize ethnic cleansing as many Polish people as possible in the like contested territories.
And, yeah, I've read statistics that vary, but one that's generally I've read a lot is probably around 100,000 Polish people were massacred, and not just with bullets because, you know, these guys did not have a lot of bullets, but like I was saying earlier with farm implements and with metal pikes and stuff like that. And not as many Jews because the Nazis were a little more, well, that was kind of their territory, but certainly quite a few Jews.
Yeah, I think it's a problem, too, for Ukrainian-Polish relations today, because I'm pretty sure Poland recognizes that as a genocide. And according to Ukraine, the people who perpetrated this ethnic cleansing or genocide, whatever you want to call it, are official heroes.
That's Black Sea mindset, baby. No genocides. No country around the Black Sea can ever commit a genocide.
But I think also something that I find really interesting about the origins of the OUN is one of the first things they do, or from the beginning, is to set their eyes on creating these front organizations in the U.S. and Canada. And so one way or another, the OUN has been active in North America for almost like for 90 years at this point, which is just kind of crazy. And yeah. So as in the 1930s, they're drifting more and more towards Nazi Germany. There's, to a lesser extent, the same is true of their allies, sympathizers in the U.S. and Canada. And so it's been a long, it's for decades they've been building up this, I guess what you could call a lobby.
You mentioned in, before we get like straight to the lobby part, you did mention something that intrigued me in an email that we exchanged earlier. You said something about like a murder house in Manhattan that I had not heard about. And I'm very curious about this.
So the main affiliate of the OUN, originally, it still exists, but it might as well not anymore. And it came to be aligned with the OUNM, but the what was called the Organization for the Rebirth of Ukraine was created in 1930, and it was headquartered in the Ukrainian National Home in Manhattan, which is at a previous location of where it is today. And so there was this, the FBI busted this, what was referred to as like a kidnap syndicate that was then traced back to the basement of the Ukrainian National Home. And that was in, I want to say, 1938. Mm-hmm. And so right around the time that this was busted, there was what was the like largest, I think to date, Ukrainian nationalist rally in New York City. And some of these leaders of the OUN came over, who would then be aligned with the OUNM in the war, and some of them were even murdered by the OUNB, which is actually more, has perhaps even more to do with the Nazi crackdown on the OUNB than their wanting to create a state, but them trying to knock off their factional rivals who had a bit of a better relationship with the Nazis at that point. But so the leader of the this front group, you know, when he's making a speech, he is said to have made a fascist salute, and it was then later explained that he allegedly didn't do that. He just made what looked like a fascist salute, and that people in the audience, thinking that's what he had done, just made the same gesture.
So he was like trying to swat a fly in front of him.
Yeah.
Just like at a very, like a diagonal angle, trying to swat a fly. And then everyone else was like, there must be a lot of flies in here. We should do the same thing.
Yeah, no, I think that's probably a good way of explaining it. Or it's a better way of explaining it than they did to the FBI. And so the FBI and the House Un-American Activities Committee was finally just kind of on the verge of taking an interest in this. But at the time, this group wasn't on the FBI's radar. And so when they busted this kidnap syndicate and this guy who had been cremated in the basement, all the victims or people who had been kidnapped all had Jewish surnames.
Hmm.
And this front group was headquartered in that building, and the people who cremated this guy in the basement, you know, themselves admitted that it stunk up the entire building. And the FBI noted, like, after the fact that the organization relocated their headquarters afterwards. And one of the people who was sent to the electric chair for it, his dad, who managed this bar in the basement, that he had helped, that he had a relationship with the guy who was known to be the fixer of this front group, which the same lawyer ends up helping pave the way for veterans of the Ukrainian Waffen-SS after the war to safely live in the United States. And so there's like all these like kind of things that do suggest that there may have been a connection or not, but was not really looked into. And then the following year, just as the war is starting, the House Un-American Activities Committee takes an interest in this front group and is referring to it as a front group that clearly has this tie-up with Nazi Germany. And yet after that, it kind of all goes away, and there wasn't really much of a fall. I mean, the FBI looked into it, but didn't
like actually pursue it or anything like that?
Yeah, it's weird because they have the, they will say, these Ukrainian nationalists would, who are familiar with this stuff, would say they were exonerated by the FBI, and I got the documents and it's not, they weren't exonerated, but they weren't,
they just like weren't busted.
Yeah, so after the war, this stuff kind of made a comeback, and then the OUNB created its own front group, and these two factions more or less kind of carved out a sort of duopoly in the Ukrainian American community, and to the point where there was this the Ukrainian National Home, now on Second Avenue, was at least through like the 80s or so affiliated still with the OUNM, and then the OUNB had its headquarters at the other end of the block, and now they've maybe, it almost looks like they've switched today.
So like they are just on, they're just switched sides of the block with each other?
Something like that. But I mean, the OUNM kind of doesn't really exist in, there isn't really evidence that they're still active in North America, yeah. Whereas the OUNB, I guess, in the long term, won out.
Let's talk about that, actually, because that's mostly what your blog deals with, is the fact that like the OUNB still exists and like certainly existed in the post-war. You mentioned the World Anti-Communist League, which for listeners of our Spider Network series, which, by the way, this is a part of, would be very familiar with that group, as they were a very important part of that. The you know, to sort of simplify this history for people, you know, like we were saying, a lot of Ukrainian nationalists cooperated with the Nazis during World War II. A lot, actually, you know, Moss made a reference to the Ukrainian Waffen-SS. Is it Nagalak? I don't know how to fucking pronounce these words.
Noctigal
Battalion.
Nightingale,
yeah. Yeah, who had a particularly brutal role in suppressing the Warsaw Uprising, if I'm not mistaken.
No, I think you're thinking of the Tronicki, but the Noctigal did become its own. It was like unofficially commanded by this guy Shakevich, who leads the Ukrainian insurgent army, and in between, the Noctigal battalion became this German auxiliary police battalion, which
the Heavies,
which in all likelihood did have a role in the shooting of Jews and quote unquote partisans in Belarus. And and then they, veterans of that, became instrumental, apparently, in the OUNB's security service, or SB, which was kind of like their equivalent of the Nazi SD, mm-hmm. Which was the SS intelligence agency. And so, yeah, they weren't good news either, but yeah.
Yeah. So after World War II, you know, I'm sure listeners will be familiar with this. Obviously, you know, we all is forgiven with the Nazis, you know, like we got to hang a few of you guys, but you know, anybody under the rank of fucking general is actually half the guys who are the rank of general. Okay with us too. In fact, some of you guys can even go on to command NATO, but, basically everything's forgiven for almost everybody, except people accused of the most egregious crimes, in which case they get like a 10-year prison sentence. And a lot of Ukrainians leave. I know the British, I believe it was the British, hand over a lot of Ukrainians living in Western Europe back to the Soviet Union. But a lot of these guys split. Stepan Bandera finds himself in Austria, I believe. And America starts like pretty quickly combing through these emigre organizations for people that might be of use in their fight against Red Russia. And the OUNB, I believe, is no different. I mean, I know you said that that Bandera himself was not the sort of chosen person by the CIA, but I know a lot of these people were like really involved in that kind of stuff, because Ukraine certainly, it's a big country, you know, tens of millions of people. They sent people back.
Yeah, and the before the CIA is created, you know, there's this whole array of U.S. intelligence agencies, and at that point, the OUNB is still kind of all together. So there was a relationship. I mean, I guess it would have been U.S. military intelligence helped shield Bandera from being deported or repatriated, or whatever you want to call it, back to the Soviet Union. You know, and people like him, the Soviet Union wasn't all too happy with. So he would have been in a little bit of trouble had he gone back. But yeah, so I mean, and it's like by the time the CIA comes around, they're kind of set on this other group led by this guy, Mykola Lebed. But the CIA does, you know, they were all on the same side, Lebed and Bandera and others in World War II. So they all had a vested interest in whitewashing that shared history. And so it's kind of this weird double speak where the CIA doesn't want to support Bandera because he's a fascist, but yet they're working with his former, like, second-ranked deputy. And I guess they weren't all, you know, it's weird because Bandera is anti-American, allegedly, and then Mykola Lebed and others are presumably pro-American. But then it's the OUNB that, you know, by the time the Cold War is over, that has hijacked the organized Ukrainian diaspora. And so they kind of trumped the CIA-backed faction over the course of the Cold War by accusing them of being crypto-communist CIA stooges. And
that's a big in the World Anti-Communist League, which I know we haven't done a full episode just on them, but it is basically a collection of everybody who ever killed a civilian during World War II that was in part of an organized right-wing group. Basically started like a it's the Fascist International, essentially, post-war Fascist International. There was the big sort of insult in it was calling people either Jewish or a communist, or a crypto Jew or a crypto communist, and I'm shocked to find that the OUN were not immune from this.
I think that's kind of the short answer for how the OUNB and such ends up getting all this influence in DC is basically via the World Anti-Communist League's star rising, via people like John Singlaub and others. And of course, that's when John Singlaub founded the last U.S. chapter of the World Anti-Communist League. And someone else on the board with him was John McCain, and John McCain's dad, who would have met Bandera's deputy, Yaroslav Stetsko, at a 1974 World Anti-Communist League conference. And I mean, like you said, I think
John McCain has his hands all over contemporary Ukrainian history. So,
yeah, and he
was all up in there in, let's just say, 2013, 2014.
And those photos of him with the neo-Nazi guy, Ola Tchaniboak, who's the leader of the Svoboda Party. That was originally the Social National Party of Ukraine, which used the Wolf's Angel swastika, and they in part based their ideology off of this guy Stetsko. And so I've always kind of imagined that when John McCain would meet with these people, that, you know, he'd say, you know, either I knew or my dad knew, you know, your hero, Yaroslav Stetsko.
That's crazy.
But it's all, yeah, it is just crazy.
It's the spider network for you, baby. Lots of fathers and sons. Like you mentioned that they have some influence in DC. So what we're looking at here is basically this motley collection of killers, of nationalists, of, you know, Jew baiters and pole murderers. A lot of them have to flee Europe en masse. Obviously a lot of them stay in Europe too. You know, I know France has like a large Eastern European sort of immigrant population from all throughout the 20th and 19th century. A lot of them come to America and sort of, you know, obviously there's already an apparatus set up for him here, like for them, you know, like we've been talking about, you know, OUN, both B and M have organizations here that, you know, they can plug into, but they get really busy. I mean, what exactly is their agenda, and like, what means do they use to further that?
Throughout the Cold War, I mean, they're pretty much explicitly in favor of World War III. That's the only apparently logical way to deal with your problems. And, you know, kind of almost like, I think these Ukrainian nationalists who put their faith in Hitler to liberate Ukraine when it should be obvious that was not what was going to happen. They then put their faith in the United States government to do that, where for part A, why that's not very strategic is the U.S. government wasn't actually, you know, trying to have a World War III, wasn't trying to break up the Soviet Union for most of it. George Kennan said that Ukraine is to the Soviet Union what Pennsylvania is to the United States. And but B, if there was any kind of conflict, it was just going to be, you know, if there was like a World War III, it was going to be a nuclear war. And, you know, Ukraine would have been totally obliterated.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that would have been like a first right target, you know, right there. I mean, it's the breadbasket of Russia. That's the funniest thing about it is like there was not a real chance of, you know, they thought the Soviet Union would invade maybe Western Europe, but there wasn't really like a chance of a full on ground invasion of the Soviet Union by America. There was just a sort of like strangulation and closing in. You know, obviously there were plans drawn up and stuff like that, but certainly like, and there were anti-communist like sort of foreign legion battalions trained in Europe as well. And in America, or at least they tried to assemble them. But yeah, it's the same sort of like really opportunistic and short-sighted thinking by these guys, which, you know, I'm glad of because fuck these guys. But I mean, I'm glad they didn't have any good ideas. It's just funny. It's just like so many of these other fascist movements that like May 1945 rolls around and bam, like overnight they switch like, oh yeah, we like America. We're moving to America. You guys, you know, whoever invades Russia next, we're with you.
Yeah. And, but I guess the part two to answer your question earlier, how they do that, I think is largely, they're just great at infiltrating. And I think their almost defining characteristic is that they're control freaks. And so they take over Ukrainian Congress Committee of America, making themselves basically the spokespeople for Ukrainian Americans. And the key person in that is this guy, Lev Dobryansky, who, I mean, he was a part of the American Security Council. He invented this thing, Captive Nations Week, which basically becomes this yearly thing that brings all these people, crypto fascists, together. And he's also a major person in the formation of the World Anti-Communist League, of course, are the OUN. So in 1980, he was the longtime president of the Ukrainian Congress Committee of America, and he also joined in on the whole, I guess you could say, smear campaign against the CIA faction as crypto communists. He greenlit this, what has been called within the Ukrainian American community, a coup of the Ukrainian Congress Committee of America, just before the 1980 U.S. election. And then ever since then, the Banderites have basically dominated the Ukrainian Congress Committee of America, and the UCCA people then got a number of appointments to the Reagan administration. And so, I mean, kind of since then, they've had this very dominating role in the Ukrainian American community. And I don't know exactly when that would have happened with Canada too, but you eventually see the same thing where they come to dominate the representative body of Ukrainian Canadians, the Ukrainian Canadian Congress. And at this point today, they control the Ukrainian World Congress. I mean, the international leader of the OUNB, a guy from Australia, is the first vice president of the Ukrainian World Congress and the current president.
I believe he called you an FSB agent, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, he and numerous other people do too. I mean, it's kind of their thing.
they think you're doing this for Russian intelligence, which is, yeah, that's nice of them to
say. Yeah, I take it as, I think it's flattering because I'm not Ukrainian. I'm not like an expert on this stuff. And yet it's all flown under the radar for so long that, you know, for someone like me to kind of come around, and I'm not the first and not the last to, I guess you could say, expose some of this stuff, but the fact that I've been able to get as far as I have, they think wouldn't be possible without me having like an FSB case officer or someone handling.
I doubt they actually think that. It's just literally anyone who's critical of Ukraine and its relationship with the United States is called a Russian asset or a Russian spy.
I think that too, but then they literally, like, it gets, like, the other day, the guy who I've had on good authority is the U.S. leader of the OUNB and also the longtime executive director of the Center for U.S.-Ukraine Relations. He sent an email out to, I don't know, who knows, number of people, and I've met him, and he refers to me as, he put my name in, like, scare quotes, like I'm a like it's a pseudonym. And I mean, it just, to me, just speaks to how crazy some of these people actually are, that they literally see
good attention to detail, though, you know. They're on top of everything.
Yeah, and it's like now their rhetoric has almost become totally normal, mainstream, you know.
It is. I mean, I think it absolutely 100% is. There isn't like a let's just say like left-wing or like nominally left-wing line on Ukraine. Like, there's not really even any discourse about Ukraine. Everyone's just sort of like, oh, what the news says, you know, they got it, you know, post-Soviet and, you know, Black Sea country is a little complicated, stay out of it. You know what I mean? Like, there just really isn't, I don't know. I think they've been very successful in dominating the discourse.
Yeah, I think the left is kind of stuck on Victoria Nuland and Chrystia Freeland, and for the most part doesn't really get past that, you know.
Yeah.
I feel like these there's like such a historical force that I think really far outweighs anything that Victoria Nuland, whoever people want to put the blame on, any one single person in the U.S. or Canadian government, you know, because the stuff has just been, they've been pushing this stuff for so long that it's just a force in and of itself.
Well, I mean, if you look at like the popularity of like the, I've never known how to pronounce it really, because I've tried to avoid this in conversation with people, but the Holodomor sort of discourse around that. I mean, that was not, when I was sort of first getting involved in extremist politics as a participant, that was not a word that I, you know, you heard flung around a lot. I mean, you heard people talk about the famines in the 30s in Ukraine and stuff like that, you know, and farm collectivization, but not necessarily referred to as such. And for those who aren't familiar with that term, that is essentially the word that Ukrainians, and actually pretty much everybody now, uses to refer to the famines in Ukraine in the 30s. As a result of many different factors, which are a little too much to get into here, and boy, do I not want to get into that. but it has become, you know, when you and I talked about this a little bit, it has become really like a copy of the way that like a lot of groups have sort of dealt with the Holocaust, as in this sort of like memification, and as this like really like this central part of Ukrainian identity is this famine.
Yeah, and it's, yeah, I mean, it's, I don't even know where to begin, but I mean, I think when you look at, it's literally like, when I say Banderites, I don't mean just in the way that Soviet or the Russian government might mean it when they just kind of use it to refer to, generally speaking, Ukrainian nationalists, but like actually members of the OUNB or its affiliated organizations have really been at the forefront of a lot of the Holodomor discourse. And I think it is this very just cynical thing for them, where, like, for one example, this summer camp near me, when I was tweeting about it, simply, and I never, you know, I got blocked by the U.S. Holodomor committee or whatever on Twitter without ever having mentioned the famine. And, you know, I look it up, it's run by this guy, it's run by people from the Ukrainian Congress Committee of America, in particular this guy who wrote something up when Yaroslav Stetsko, the OUNB leader, who was himself a Nazi collaborator and vicious anti-Semite and war criminal, died. He wrote an obituary. And but for them, it's like, so I criticize this Ukrainian summer camp, and I'm getting messages from Ukrainian-American teenagers like, oh, you're a Holodomor denier. When, like, I've never mentioned it. And it's basically like, you know, if you're speaking about Israel and Palestine, people will conflate anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism, but I've never criticized Israel and then have someone turn around and be like, oh, so you're a Holocaust denier? Yeah, and that's literally how it goes with being saying something about, you're glorifying Nazi collaborators. And like, I'm not a Holocaust denier, you're a Holodomor denier. Yeah. And it's I don't know. It's just kind of absurd, because
it's super absurd because they helped do the Holocaust.
Yeah, and these Western Ukrainians were not part of the Soviet Union that was suffering from the famine. And yet they are the spokespeople. Yeah. And then they're the spokespeople for it. And I mean, okay, here's just one thing. The Ukrainian World Congress International Holodomor Committee is chaired by the literal leader of the OUNB, this guy from Australia. The leader of the so-called International Council in Support of Ukraine, which is like the coordinating body of OUNB-affiliated organizations around the world, himself in the late 1970s led this campaign in the U.S. against the showing of the television movie series Holocaust, starring Meryl Streep and James Woods, I think.
Never heard of that. James Woods probably has a slightly different opinion on that by now. But
I think that like TV movie series was part of this rising awareness of the Holocaust and Ukrainian participation in the Holocaust. I think they had an episode dedicated to Ukraine and that. And then Ivan Demyanyuk, the thought to be death camp guard at Treblinka, turned out to be another one at Sobibor. But all this renewed attention on Ukrainian participation in the Holocaust in the 70s and 80s, there was this knee-jerk thing, like, let's focus on the famine to
distract counteract from it. Right, yeah. Right.
And I mean, it's just, yeah, like, it's so cynical that, like, the word is even...
Yeah, I mean, it's another...
It's like, come on.
It's not a total coincidence.
That's our word.
And it's, yeah, it's just the most cynical thing I think I've ever come across. That, because they're, you know, if any Ukrainian nationalist is listening to this, they'll act like they're so outraged that we'd even have this conversation. And yet, you know, it's these, it's literally the Banderites who did this to themselves, like, in...
Yeah.
Using it all as a basically distraction from
the cudgel, yeah.
Yeah.
And so we got the Banderites in America, and of course, you know, up until the 90s, we have Ukraine, you know, as part of the, basically as part of the USSR. Once the Soviet Union ceases to exist and Ukraine has freed itself from the shackles of their Eurasian tyranny coming from Moscow, the tendrils of neo-Stalinism, Bandera makes something of a comeback, because, you know, for listeners can imagine, Stepan Bandera's name was not exactly synonymous with, it wasn't exactly shouted from the halls of schools and playgrounds during the time when there was a Ukrainian SSR, but post 90s or rather in the 90s and until today, the sort of cult around Stepan Bandera has grown and grown and grown. And really, I mean, just continues to explode. And so I think it's we would be remiss not to talk a little bit about modern Ukrainian politics, because the shadow of Bandera and the shadow of essentially all of the 20th century and late 19th century Ukrainian nationalism is really cast over modern Ukraine.
Yeah, and just kind of like with the Holodomor stuff, I mean, I think The OUNB, which, you know, by the time the Soviet Union collapsed, was almost entirely based in the Ukrainian diaspora, that this diaspora-led network really has been at the forefront of basically Ukraine's more controversial memory politics. And so that goes hand in hand for them, is the Holodomor stuff and then also the glorification of Bandera and other fascist Nazi collaborators. And so the OUNB today kind of poses as more center-right or more like respectable nationalists today, but there are connections to be made between them and the far right, but the memory politics stuff is kind of what unites all these people, is, you know, all neo-Nazis and your more quote-unquote respectable nationalists all are fully on board with the whole Bandera cult. And, you know, I think a pretty good example of that is, you know, the like torchlit marches you get in Ukraine today led by the far right. Whereas during the Cold War, I mean, I know for a fact at least the 25th anniversary of Bandera's 1959 assassination by the KGB. So in 1984 in Munich, they had a torchlit march in Munich. Like, and so there's...
I mean, Yukashenko was going to give him, like, a posthumous award for, like, the national hero of Ukraine.
Yeah, and at the time, the first lady of Ukraine was a Ukrainian-American woman from Chicago who was a mentee of Lev Dobryansky, who I mentioned earlier. And so there's, like, a direct connection between this.
The spider network.
So that's, I mean, I think a lot of, I mean, people who are maybe of a more advanced age, like some of us, might remember from the 2013-2014 Euromaidan protests in Ukraine that at first they were presented to us as, you know, there's another sort of Belarus-style, you know, Eastern Bloc, you know, post-Soviet dictator who's, you know, Russia-controlled, whatever. And then there are these, like, beautiful, brave young people who want the Ukraine to sort of join the European community. It was because you know, you was refusing to sign this, like, paper that would, you know, commit Ukraine to further integration with Western Europe. And then I started noticing... a large amount of black and red flags at these protests. And it's funny because some people I actually know were like, oh, they're anarchist flags. They're anarcho-syndicalists. Uh-huh. And because
anarcho-syndicalists for the EU.
Yeah. Well, it became sort of clear that it was not necessarily for the EU that some of these people were fighting, which, by the way, the EU, not a fan of that. But the Banderite flag and what's sort of now just like, I don't know which exact groups use it anymore in Ukraine, but the Banderite flag is a black and red flag with sort of diagonal cross there, diagonally black and red. The same as the anarcho-syndicalist flag.
Or no, it's horizontal.
Horizontal. Yes, you're right. It's horizontal. Excuse me. So different than the anarcho-syndicalist flag. But, the Euromaidan protests really quickly got some what looked like really heavy muscle from these groups and these right wing groups, and it, you know, it appeared to somebody from afar like me is that these were the groups, like these sort of neo fascist groups, these hard right, you know, sort of integralist fascist, whatever you want to call them, they were all different kinds of groups, were like really gaining a lot of power. I mean, they were taking over hotels, they were killing policemen, like they were ready, like these were actual revolutionary groups. Yeah, and that was wild to see.
And I think people didn't, it's like even Russia didn't make, I don't think, much of a stir of this, but the literal OUNB like had a pretty significant role in a lot of that. Like Right Sector got a lot of the attention, but Right Sector was, which was kind of formed right at the beginning of the Euromaidan as this coalition of far-right groups, including some neo-Nazi elements, but the creation of Right Sector was led by this group called the Trident, which was in the 90s, was literally like the OUNB's paramilitary group. And it then went off and did its own thing. So it's like Right Sector isn't officially tied to the OUNB today, but it is basically more closely resembles the OUNB of the 1930s and 40s. Like they're the like the really radical, true Banderite believers today. And then even Svoboda, the guy Oleksandr Sych, who becomes the deputy prime minister of Ukraine after the Euromaidan, and he was at the time talked about like he's one of the chief ideologues of Svoboda. He was tied up with the OUNB as recently as 2006. And so it's like, it does seem that in addition to having their own groups, the OUNB has once again done this game of infiltrating others. And I think even the deputy leader of the OUNB in 2013-14, and I'm forgetting his name, but he was, I think he was in charge of the headquarters of the Maidan Self-Defense, which was the like militia,
yeah,
structure. And the head of it was this neo-Nazi guy, Pyro B, who's gotten a lot of attention. And then someone else who was involved in that was Andre Levus, or L-E-V-U-S. And he's someone who I think could, you know, potentially be the new leader of the OUNB in Ukraine. I don't know that, but he's definitely... I mean, it's like there's just... There are all these connections to be made, and the Euromaidan was, like, hijacked by the far right, but then the literal OUNB did have, like, a role to play in all of that.
I think, too, like, just... I mean, we probably... can and will do a whole episode on Maidan because there's a lot to talk about there, and we don't need to get into all of it, but I do think like something that you said earlier I think is worth like bringing back up here is you said they're really good at infiltrating groups, and that's been like one of your biggest takeaways with the Ukrainian nationalists. And like one thing to understand to our listeners who aren't familiar with the kind of like what happened during Maidan and also like afterwards is that like we're not just talking about like a bunch of like paramilitary groups randomly. Like these people are also very well connected with the Atlantic Council and have friends at NATO, and we mentioned our good friend John McCain and other you know members of Congress and people in the UK and the EU, etc. Like through these quote unquote respectable front groups, they're essentially front groups that you're kind of like outlining. Whether it's, you know, I mean, the Atlantic Council has that whole initiative called like Ukraine in Europe or whatever, right? And that is, I think that was after Maidan that was launched. But the point being that like it was a continuation of that project of utilizing these kind of right wing fascist nationalist connections in order to, you know, I mean, for US and EU interests in you know, making sure the regime change was continuing to be successful.
And the Ukraine in Europe initiative that you mentioned was, it was itself started with a partnership between the Atlantic Council and the Ukrainian World Congress.
Yes, the Ukrainian World Congress. That's the one I was thinking of. Yeah.
And that's like literally controlled by the OUNB. And so, I mean, that's just one example, but they do have ties to the Atlantic Council. And yeah, and it's kind of like the whole point of these front groups is they get to pose as representatives, not just of the OUNB, but the Ukrainian diaspora and I guess to a lesser extent today, but Ukrainian Americans and Ukrainian Canadians have exerted a lot of influence, and you know they can make the difference in elections more locally. But
Don Hughes, in particular, here.
Yeah, and it's probably something too that you know the Biden campaign is thinking about too. Is you know because the Ukrainian American community used to be pretty solidly Republican, and now.
Well, his son did a bang up job over there, right?
Oh yeah,
that's what he was doing. It's called soft diplomacy, Liz. You wouldn't know anything about it.
Man.
He's just over there to make friends and connections to further American interests abroad.
Don't get me fucking started on that. This shit pisses me off too, because like, you know, fucking Ukraine Gate is real, man. Like that shit happened and is real. We don't even have time to get into like we have to do another episode because like, you know, all of this like kind of like fascist history is so important for then understanding, you know, the mass amounts of private equity grift that happened because of Euromaidan and NATO and the Atlantic Council getting their tentacles in there and continuing to make sure that, you know, it's like they think they can softly manage the, I mean, this is my understanding is, and tell me if I'm, I don't know, incorrect, but it seems like now these guys think, or the idea is like, oh, we can just continue to soft manage these like kind of fascists in here. So long as we can keep, you know, shoring up our capital investment and we can keep, you know, we'll get them to hire Hunter Biden like they did back then, or, you know, whoever else in the future. And we're going to keep opening up all the agricultural sectors and we're going to, you know, create this wall against Russia, whatever. And what it seems like if you keep up with what's going on in Ukraine, like today, is that it's unclear if anyone has control over these far right groups. And it's like even calling them far right is like not even appropriate. Like explicitly Nazi, explicitly fascist. Like if I'm telling you, man, they're like, fuck, these are like legit scary dudes.
They literally like video and live stream going into Romani. I don't know why I pronounced it like that, just because it's like not a word I'm used to saying.
Roma
encampments in the woods, yeah. And just like tearing encampments apart, beating people. I mean, when I was there, I spent 2.5-3 weeks there. Most of it in Odessa, which is not. I mean, that's in southern Ukraine, not in western Ukraine. So this stuff is not as popular there. Bandera. They actually polled about Bandera there. He polls worse in southern Ukraine, I think, than anywhere else, especially because it has a historical Jewish population, as showcased in the works of Isaac Babel, very good writer. But I saw like legions of pudgy youth. And that's what did stand out to me was their dumpiness, marching down the street in black t-shirts, black pants. I can't remember what flag. They had some flag I hadn't seen before, and then they also had the regular Ukrainian flag. And you know, in Odessa too, you know, they burned the trade union hall with a lot of what they called pro Russians inside of it, and burned a bunch of people alive. It's a frightening thing. But what I sort of like, the impression I get is because like I cannot stress enough that like Ukrainian politics outside of these far right parties. None of the like liberal democratic parties seem to have much of what you could call grassroots support, and they certainly do not have private militias. And so like the way I sort of think about it is like, okay, well, you had your sort of February revolution in the Maidan protests, but like the problems that existed in Ukraine before that revolution were not solved. You know, there is still massive amounts of graft and corruption as showcased by employee Hunter Biden. It's like the general sort of like sentiment of people that I met there was like, oh yeah, this government's fucked up, you know, sort of just like the last government, but it's like, what are you going to do? But these right-wing groups are able to harness like that power. And so like there is like a tremendous amount of far-right and neo-Nazi involvement in government there. But if things kind of keep continuing, I could see that becoming let's say less, not marginalized, because you certainly couldn't call it marginalized, but more at the forefront and possibly like another revolution.
Well, that's what they want. And I mean, that's what I think is scary, because that's going to, I think what you said with like the February revolution, and then this would be kind of like their October revolution. I think at this point, the neo-Nazis and the far right would be a more significant role than they were in 2013-14. Mm-hmm. And the thing that's unique about the OUNB is it's got these connections to the diaspora, which in turn have connections and influence with political systems and society in the US and Canada and Australia and so forth. And I guess the thing is, it's like the OUNB really does kind of pose as kind of like the bridge between the establishment and the far right, and I guess they kind of feel like that gives them the ability to manage the situation. But I think it would be something I've been coming back to is thinking how I feel like if they tried to have another revolution, that it'd be kind of like their 1941 all over again, where when they think they're going to have their Banderite revolution or whatever, is when the Nazis are going to come in and shut it down, and then they're going to take over. And I think it's like this OUNB, Bandera lobby, whatever you want to call it, is they're not neo-Nazis, but they are neo-Nazi collaborators and enablers and sympathizers. And one example of that is Ulana Sopruun, who was the healthcare minister of Ukraine, Ukrainian-American. She's evidently friendly with one of the leaders of the neo-Nazi groups that was behind the anti-Roma violence you mentioned. And she's also a favorite of the Atlantic Council, and yet she seems to be herself more than likely a member of the OUNB. She's
not surprising.
Yeah. She was part of the Ukrainian World Congress.
If she's for Medicare for all, like that is like, to be clear, like that's a Nazi program. You know, and well, so like it's,
if they want to have an October revolution, they better pray for a Biden win, because the only way they're getting one is if the US backs it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Obama had to be in there the first time.
And I think someone who concerns me with Biden is Michael Carpenter, who's kind of, who was, I think, for point, the assistant secretary.
Listeners, get your notepads out. Get your notepads out for this one.
Well, he was the, I think, assistant secretary of defense at some point for Russia and Ukraine. And in any case, he was kind of, you know, Biden was like the point person in the White House for Ukraine. And then Michael Carpenter was one of his point people. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And Michael Carpenter has gotten wrapped up with the Center for U.S.-Ukraine Relations, which I feel like I can say with no fear of being accused of defamation or whatever, is just more or less an OUNB front. And
Jesus
I tried to attend one of their events in March, and that's, and I got one of the people, it actually walked in when Michael Carpenter was having his panel discussion, and one of the people who I know to allegedly be one of the OUNB leaders in the U.S., well, two of them, they both got up, one of them off their panel with Michael Carpenter to, like, escort me out of the room.
Wait, he got up off the panel with, like, a Biden advisor to get you out of the room?
Yeah, and then we took a photo together, and,
What?
Yeah, and, they're the ones who think I'm an FSB agent or whatever.
That's amazing.
But I wanted to ask Michael Carpenter, like, do you realize who you're dealing with, kind of a thing.
I think they might, and they're okay with it.
Yeah,
considering it was so successful the first time, why would they stop?
I don't know if I really want to. I kind of giving him a little bit of the benefit of the doubt, but there are people who they work with who I'm sure know the truth about all this. Number one being Herman Perchner, who's the founding president of the neoconservative American Foreign Policy Council.
Yes.
He's particularly close with all of them, and I think he was going to run. He was very close to Newt Gingrich.
Yes.
I mean, yeah, I think they all know. I don't know. I think they all know. They were very, very all. They were all very active in 2013, 2014. They had a lot. There were a lot of bipartisan support over there in Ukraine.
Yeah, I think it does kind of also raise questions of where the CIA stands on this stuff today, because Michael Lebed and these others they're working with were supposed to be the respectable ones who had been reformed.
Right, right, right.
And
these guys are like garish. These guys now are like in your face Nazis. They're not respectable Nazis.
It's really hard for them not to say stuff about Jews.
Well, except these are the ones, the Diaspora Network. Yeah, in a way, speaking of front groups, it's almost like the OUNB is itself a front group because it poses as moderate. And then, meanwhile, they've got these crazy cousins in Ukraine who are, hardcore far right. And
who, by the way, are literally part of the Ukrainian military. Like, Azov Battalion, stuff like that. Like, they are on the front lines, armed, even after they're supposed to be disarmed, being trained, by the way, by NATO members. I think they were being trained by Canada and England, and I mean, I'm sure America too, but I've just seen footage of Canada and England. There are NATO advisors on the ground training guys with swastika tattoos who would love to rip you out of your fucking house and kill you.
Yeah, and the U.S. support, I think, was barred at some point, but it's like, that's just like tip of the iceberg, basically.
Yeah. Well, Moss, we got to wrap up. In a sec, I get so excited talking about this stuff that the time got away from me. Is there anything like, so I want to tell listeners to check out Bandera Lobby. It's fucking phonetic. Don't make me spell Bandera for you.
Bandera Lobby. BANDERALOBBY.SUBSTACK.COM.
Damn, I who am I to interrupt the queen?
BanderaLobby.substack.com.
You can see Moss's work there. Moss, do you have any parting words for our dear listeners there?
Well, I guess to plug a couple things, doing this podcast series, this podcast called The Farm, about the World Anti-Communist League.
Oh, yeah.
We just did our fourth of what will probably be 7 or 8 episodes or so, and the last one was 3 hours, and we spent a lot of it talking about this guy, Lev Dobryansky. We also didn't get too much into Canada and just did a podcast with Alberta Advantage talking about the Canadian side of things some more. which is basically the what's going on in the U.S., but even worse. Yeah, I don't know. I don't have any good news or anything. But.
Such as it is these days. Thank you so much. This is so fun.
Yeah, no, thank you.
That farm podcast, of course, by friend of the pod, Recluse, who appeared on, I believe, our first Spider Network show.
Yes.
Cannot recommend enough. I've listened to a couple of the ones with Moss. Very good podcast overall if you're interested in the parapolitical. Moss, thank you a ton, and we'll see you next time.
Thanks so much.
I got these tea tree oil fucking, these tea tree therapy toothpicks. Quitting what? Toothpicks?
Smoking.
Oh, no.
Oh, that's usually my pop, though.
No. No, baby, ooh. I just smoke
he
so much.
He wheezes in response to that.
baby, no. No, I've gone back. You see these fucking things I got? Look at these things.
You're not smoking those. Come on.
I'm smoking the research cigarette. A listener sent me rat cigarettes that are meant for rats, and they're called research cigarettes, tobacco health research, and let me tell you, they're not exactly the best tasting flavor, but they do have a lot of tar, and that's what I look for in a ciggy.
I don't want you to smoke those.
I had a changing the subject. I thought that interview was fun.
It was. I love talking about Ukraine. Mm-hmm. And at some point, we're going to have to talk about Poland, which gives me great... that does not make me feel good.
We should talk about Poland right now, Liz.
I don't want to.
I have something to tell you. Mm. I've purchased a majority share in the country of Poland.
That actually might be possible.
I'm handing it over to you. You are now technically the Duchess of Poland.
I don't know if I want that. You know, when you mentioned integralism in the interview, I was like, yeah, that's Poland.
Yeah, exactly. Just getting really mad about the 8 immigrants in Poland.
Not a good situation there.
I'm like, guys, how can you guys be anti-immigrant? People are anti-immigrant against you everywhere else. Like, come on.
Yeah.
Also, no, there's none here. But yeah, I know. It's there's not that many there. We'll get to Poland someday. We should go there and investigate. We should solve Poland.
I'm gonna shut down this conversation before either of us says something that gets us in trouble.
I guess that's true. Yeah, people have tried to solve Poland. And so anyways, that was a fun episode. You are never talking about Eastern Europe again because Liz gave me that look right there because I was about to say something about Poland.
Oh my God.
We will be dealing solely with countries in Micronesia.
Yes. Or just Central Europe. We're only talking about France.
All right, look.
Everyone's favorite country.
Czechia. That's a bunch of bullshit that they did that. I want to register. I think I speak for all of us here. You can't just change it to Czechia.
Yeah,
it's terrible. What was wrong with the Czech Republic?
Czechia, awful.
Don't take the out of the name because then it fucks me up.
Yeah, because now we're supposed to say, oh, it's not the Ukraine. It's not the Czech Republic. No.
Yeah, I'm still. Well, I found a balance. I'm just calling it the Czechia from now on. So all good, which makes it sound like a zone in like a futuristic city.
The Chaz and Czechia, very similar.
Well, Chaz actually was based off of the 1921 Czech Republic Constitution, the first Czech Republic. What's that guy? Benes, or whatever. Yeah, he actually was technically they had his picture everywhere in Chaz. It was heavily Czech influenced zone.
When we. You know, people that were angry at Chaz should have just started calling them nationalists.
Chaz nationalists. Well, I will say, like, the police in Seattle is, like, notoriously has, like, a pro-Slovak bias. And so, like, bias? I'm not biased. Yeah, they're always making me mispronounce
the diaspora.
Words. Listen, let's shut it down.
Yeah, I gotta go.
I'm so hot. I'm still really warm. All right, my name is The Brace.
I'm Liz.
Joined by producer Young Chomsky.
And we will see you next time. Bye-bye.